he answered, slapping his chest. You give them to El Niño, he work for you. I shook my head. But you can't wear them all the time. Why not? Miss Howard asked, turning to me. Frankly, Stevie, I think this fellow can do just about as he pleases. I gave that a second's thought, then nodded. Yeah, you've got a point there, all right. But what the hell's the doctor going to say? When we tell him that we've brought one of our main opponents over to our side? Miss Howard countered with a smile. What do you think he's going to say? I kept nodding, and then thought about our host in Ballston Spa. And Mr. Picton? I didn't even have to wait for the words. Miss Howard just gave me a look, and I smiled. Yeah, you're right, he'll laugh himself sick. And this guy'll give him a run for his money in the gab department, that's a fact. Well, then. Miss Howard turned to the Aborigine. All right, she said, indicating the bed of the buckboard. Climb aboard and tell us what we should call you. Call me El Niño, he said, slapping his chest again. Then his face grew more cautious. I work for you? He asked, as if he didn't quite believe it. You work for us, Miss Howard answered. Now get in. No, no, it is not right, so El Niño can walk while the lady rides. Miss Howard sighed. No, El Niño, that is not right. If you work for us, you're one of us, and that means you ride with us. Looking about ready to bust, the Aborigine did a little piece of a dance in the roadway, then sprang onto the bed of the buckboard with the speed of a jungle cat. He stood up on the bed behind us, grinning from ear to ear. With El Niño to work for you, he declared. You fine, baby Anna. Sure. Not quite believing or understanding what we'd gotten ourselves into, I gave the Morgan the reins, and we headed for home. We got the full story of El Niño's life on that trip, one what we relayed to the others once we'd reached Mr. Picton's house. It seemed that as a boy in the jungles of the Philippines' Luzon Island, the Aborigine had been out hunting with the men of his tribe one day when they'd been set upon by a party of Spaniards. The older Aetas had been killed for sport. The younger ones had been taken to Manila and sold into a lifetime of bondage. El Niño had escaped his first master after several years, then spent his early manhood haunting the waterfront and becoming a roving mercenary. He'd done time as a pirate, fought in small wars all over the South China Sea, and finally found his way back to Manila, where he'd been arrested for petty thievery. Brought before a Spanish magistrate, he'd been sentenced to life at hard labor, which was when the older Señor Linares, a diplomatic official, had stepped in and given him a chance to work off his debt to the Spanish Empire as a household servant. I couldn't help when I heard all this but think of my own experiences with Dr. Kreitzler, and this common background quickly formed a bond between me and our new partner. He was a character, there was no denying that much. Everybody in Mr. Picton's house found his strange mixture of manly posturing and gentle, almost childlike kindness to be both amusing and touching. When he met Cyrus in particular, he behaved in a way what was very affecting yet still kind of comical. He bowed in a deep, respectful manner and was amazed when the bigger man, who he seemed to think was some kind of oracle, actually offered him his hand. The fact that Mr. Montrose, as El Niño would always pronounce it, lived among whites as a trusted equal, wearing the same clothes they did, eating the same food, and sleeping in the same quality of accommodations, seemed to the Aborigine to mean that he had attained a high level of secret knowledge, and El Niño set out to model his behavior on that of my big, quiet friend. Such, of course, was no easy task for such a chatty, active little fellow. None of this, though, gave us any better idea of what we were going to do with our new ally. We didn't particularly need anybody followed or rendered unconscious at the moment, and he was bound to cause comment wherever he went in Ballston Spa, especially after I gave him the evening clothes I'd promised, which he put on right away. Strutting around like a peacock, he'd been right in supposing that the clothes would fit him, he looked ready to take on the world. But we all wondered if the world would be similarly prepared for him. Thinking for the moment of practicalities, a confused Mrs. Hastings put El Niño to work washing up the dinner dishes, a job what he took to with great good spirits. As for the information Miss Howard and I brought back from Stillwater, it was duly posted on the chalkboard in Mr. Picton's living room. Then we moved out onto the back porch to talk over the importance of the tale. It was no surprise to anybody that Mrs. Muhlenberg hadn't known the full details of the Hatch case, being as she lived in a different township, which meant a different sheriff's department, and small-town sheriffs were generally even less cooperative and communicative with each other than New York City police precincts. As for the poor woman's refusal to testify, Mr. Picton informed us that such was no great loss, being, as Saratoga County's resident Solomon Judge Charles H. Brown was a stickler for trying every case on its own merits, and almost certainly wouldn't have allowed any unproven allegations about something what had happened 10 years ago to reach a jury's ear. The same held true for all the work we'd done in New York, which, our host firmly reminded us, hadn't even resulted in an official police investigation. The case of Libby Hatcher's murdered children would have to be confined to just that. The only purpose Mrs. Muhlenberg's story could serve would be to help us better understand the character of the woman we were dealing with. What had offered us along these lines was further proof, not that we needed any, of just how clever our opponent was. The doctor told us that Mrs. Muhlenberg's little theory of how Libby had killed her son, Michael, a tale what some might have written off as the ramblings of a woman driven half-mad by grief, was very likely the truth. Such substances as poison taken by a nursing woman can, in fact, pass on through her milk into whatever baby she's feeding. As for the packet of black powder Mrs. Muhlenberg had found in Libby's room along with the arsenic, the doctor suspected that it had been, to use his term, carbo animalis purificatus, Latin for purified animal charcoal. The rest of the world knows the stuff as bone black, and it's commonly used as an antidote for many poisons, including arsenic. Libby had probably kept it handy just in case she got impatient with her plan and took too high a dose of the arsenic herself. As for why she'd done what she'd done, we all knew the answer to that one by now. Little Michael Muhlenberg had committed the lethal mistake of making it obvious that Libby didn't have much in the way of maternal talents. And instead of just admitting as much and trying to find something else to do with her life, the murderess had concocted a situation in which she came off looking like a hero for her efforts to save a kid she was actually killing. It was the same pattern we'd identified in the cases of Libby's adopted children along with the babies at the lying-in hospital. The woman had been at her grim work far longer than any of us, except, of course, the doctor, had suspected, or likely would have believed. There was one bit of information, what passed for a helpful clue contained in Mrs. Muhlenberg's sorry tale. If Libby Hatch had been hiring herself out as a wet nurse, it meant that she had to have given birth to a child of her own at some point. If Libby hadn't been lying on the hospital forms we'd seen and was now 39, then in 1886 she would have been 28, and said kid could have been anywhere from an infant to my age, although the fact that she'd shown up at the Muhlenbergs alone indicated that the child was probably dead, which came as no big surprise to any of us. But dead or alive, there had to be some evidence of his or her existence somewhere. So Miss Howard and I would now be looking for more than just Libby's parents over on the east side of the Hudson. Most probably another child's grave awaited us, too. The interview with Mrs. Muhlenberg had given us only a general idea of where to start our search. There was a whole string of small towns on the opposite bank of the river, and because of that we needed to get started as soon as possible. I think Miss Howard would have been just as happy to leave that night, but there was no way I was going anywhere in the dark again. Besides, we owed El Nino his first night in the bed we'd promised him. Mr. Picton showed him to a room up on the top floor of the house, the two of them chatting like old chums as they went up the stairs. We'd been right in thinking that their vocal natures would make them friends from the start. As for what in the world would become of El Nino once the case was over, Mr. Picton said he wouldn't at all mind keeping him on as a servant. It'd certainly give the citizens of Ballston Spa something to talk about. His fate happily decided in this manner, the aborigine dove into the moderately sized bed in his room like it was an ocean, pausing in his wild celebration only when Mr. Picton told him that Mrs. Hastings wouldn't appreciate his rolling around in the bedding with my dress shoes on. The doctor decided that our new partner would continue to work with Miss Howard and me for the immediate future. It was impossible to predict what kind of new trouble our search for Libby Hatch's origins would stir up, but it was safe to say that if we did run into more danger, El Niño's talents would come in handy. This was an easy enough consideration to see and accept. What wasn't so obvious, but would prove pleasantly true over the next 2 days, was just how amusing our companion would continue to be. As we scrounged around those villages on the east bank of the Hudson, with Miss Howard asking anybody and everybody she could find about the Fraser family, El Niño and I became better and better friends, clowning, laughing, and telling any troublesome or resentful locals we ran into just where they could take their small-town hostility. The Aborigines' fierce loyalty, now enthusiastically transferred to us after years of being reluctantly given to the mean-spirited son of his original benefactor, caused Miss Howard to develop her own attachment to him, in a way what wouldn't have been possible with your average American white male. There was no condescension or attempt at chivalry in El Niño's approach to her, just simple respect for someone who'd done him a good turn. We needed all the bright spirits we could muster during that first day of our search, for it produced nothing but negative answers to Miss Howard's questions, and more moody, distrustful stares from the local population. The fact that we were pursuing a murderer didn't seem to cut much ice with those people. We were, first and foremost, strangers, and no constructive goal of ours could remove that barrier. Wednesday night found us back at Mr. Picton's with nothing to show for our efforts, but we got up before dawn on Thursday and headed out again, trying not to let frustration get to us. When sunrise did come, we were crossing the river on a small ferry, heading directly into the bright, harsh morning glare. It was a state of affairs what would have been sickening if it hadn't been for El Niño, who lay in the back of the buckboard, sharpening his crease and happily singing some song in his native tongue, what he informed me was about mourning in the tropical jungles that had once been his home. The rest of our morning was filled with more disappointment, as was our afternoon. Town after town, tavern after tavern, postal office after postal office went by, with Miss Howard diligently dragging herself into every establishment and asking the same set of questions about a family named Fraser. By the time the light started to turn golden, I, for one, was more than willing to acknowledge the hopelessness of our finding anything out before the grand jury convened. We didn't even know, after all, if Fraser had been Libby Hatch's original name, an alias, or the handle what the father of her first child had gone by. All we felt sure of was that somewhere, maybe in a completely different state, there was a grave with that first kid's name on it. And as late afternoon wound on into early evening, Miss Howard, too, began to think that maybe such was all we really needed to know, at least for the time being. If Mr. Picton found that he required more specifics concerning that portion of the woman's life for the actual trial, assuming we got that far, we could keep trying to find them, and he could grill Libby about such matters on the stand, too. But more and more, Miss Howard was starting to feel that Libby's violence was as much a result of having been born a girl in an oppressive, hypocritical society as it was of any possible irregularities in her family life. And our fruitless, pressured search was starting to seem like a waste of time as a result. Needless to say, Miss Howard wasn't one to put up with such a feeling for very long. And so, when the courthouse clock in Ballston Spa tolled out 7 o'clock that evening, we found ourselves in a position to hear it, having made our way back into town along the Malta Road. We wound through Ballston's closed shops and quiet houses, then around the train depot and up Bath Street, passing beneath Mr. Picton's window. El Niño was sleeping in the bed of the wagon, Miss Howard was deep in her own thoughts as she rode next to me, and I was having a tough time keeping my eyes open as my mind was lulled into relaxation by the slow, steady clatter of our faithful Morgan's hooves. Which, of course, was exactly the sort of moment when all hell was bound to break loose. "Stevie!" I half thought the voice was in my head, part of some dream I was slipping into. "Stevie! Sarah! Damn it, can't you hear me?" Miss Howard roused me, and together we turned to look at the quiet blocks around us, failing to see a single soul. But when the voice called out to us again, I marked it as Mr. Picton's and realized it was coming from his office window. "Up here," he said, at which point we glanced up to see him hanging almost half out of the courthouse, waving his pipe in one hand and a piece of paper in the other, trying desperately to get our attention. "Listen, Stevie," he went on, "you've got to get out to the Westons and bring the doctor back here. They don't have a blasted telephone, and we need to talk. He was going to be back by 9, but I've just had a wire from John. We've got to go over it now." "But the hearing's in the morning," Miss Howard tried to answer, "and he's still got to—" "That doesn't matter. All taken care of," Mr. Picton shouted, confusing the hell out of both Miss Howard and me. "Sarah, you'd better take my surrey and go fetch Lucius and Cyrus. But, Stevie, you've got to get the doctor as fast as you can." In one quick move, Miss Howard jumped to the ground, starting toward High Street and the courthouse steps at a run. She turned around when she was about halfway there to tell me, "Wake El Nino up, Stevie. He can keep you from drifting off again." "Like that's gonna happen," I said, full of new energy. "I want to know what the hell's going on." Miss Howard smiled, gathered her skirt together, and turned to keep running. Thinking the matter over, I figured I could in fact use some company to break the monotony of a drive back along the road we'd just come in on, so I gave my companion on the bed of the wagon a good shake, causing him to bolt upright, produce his crease, and ready himself to throw it all in one lightning move. "Take it easy, son," I said, patting the driver's bench where Miss Howard had been sitting. "Come on up here and grab a hold of something. The ride's about to get a little rough." With a gleeful laugh at the idea of being graduated to the bench, El Nino jumped up beside me and got ready to roll as I turned the wagon around and slapped the reins against the Morgan's backside. We wouldn't be able to travel full speed until we got outside town again, but once we did, the little stallion showed he was no worse for the day's work. And as we barreled along, we raised such a cloud of dust, not to mention such an unholy racket, that El Nino couldn't resist breaking into another song, what he told me he'd picked up during his pirating days in the South China Sea. It was still fully light out when we reached the Westons' farm, a testament as much to the durability of our horse as to my driving talents. Josiah Weston, though taken off guard by the sight of the Aborigine in my evening clothes, told me that the doctor and Clara Hatch were somewhere down by the stream behind the house once again drawing. This didn't surprise me. The doctor had amazing patience when it came to these things, and if a given kid responded to a certain form of treatment or communication, he could stay with it for days on end. Telling El Nino to get some feed and water for our horse, I took off down toward the stream at a run. Shooting around the big vegetable garden, then through a cornfield, and down along the banks of the loud, clear brook, I found myself getting more and more excited. About just what, I had no idea. I jumped and bolted over the rocks and muddy grass of the stream bank, searching for the doctor and Clara, but not finding them right off. And even though I knew that they wouldn't be able to hear me over the noise of the rushing water, I called out their names a couple of times, never pausing to listen for an answer. Finally, after some 5 minutes of dashing and leaping, I caught sight of the doctor's back about half a mile upstream from the house. He was sitting underneath a large maple tree, one whose roots had grown out to form a kind of platform over the stream bed. Clara was sitting quietly across from him, sketching away. When I finally did get within earshot of the doctor, I slowed down a bit. The part of the stream where the two of them were sitting was a little bend, where the water spread out into an undisturbed pool and grew quiet enough for me to hear the doctor's gentle voice as he spoke with Clara. He was obviously at a critical juncture in his effort to reach the girl, based on what I could hear of his words. "And so you see, Clara, I began to understand that what had happened was not my fault, and that if I only told others the truth about what had happened, it would help. It would help me to stay safe, and it would help my father to stop doing such things." This was all fairly predictable. Again, I'd heard its like before from the doctor, and though I knew enough to approach quietly, I also calculated that a pause in the conversation, brought on by Clara's silent attempt to wrap her troubled young mind around his last thought, would follow. I waited for it, figuring that at said point I could gracefully step in and break the news that we were urgently needed back in town. What happened instead was that my jaw dropped at the sound of Clara answering the doctor in a soft, slightly hoarse, but still amazingly clear voice. "And did your papa get better?" I could see the doctor nod slowly. "He was a very sick man. like your mama. But yes, he got better, eventually. So will she.
But only if I tell the truth, Clara said, quietly, and with real fear.
There was no doubt about it. They were having a conversation. Chapter 39. I did my damnedest not to interrupt the scene, knowing that what was happening was crucial. But the sogginess of the stream bank below me prevented the attempt. Standing there holding my breath, I began to feel my foot sinking into a deep patch of grassy mud. Letting out a little holler, I yanked my leg up, a move what produced a loud and slightly humorous sound. The pair of these noises caused the doctor and Clara to spin round quickly and get to their feet. The little girl rushed to hide behind the doctor's leg, though when she saw it was only me, and then that the bottom of my leg was covered in a thick sludge, she began to laugh some in that hoarse little way of hers. The doctor smiled, too. As for me, I could feel my own face going red. "Sorry," I said, shaking chunks of clay and mud off my boot. "I didn't mean to barge in, but..." I just looked down at my foot, and then the two of them laughed even harder. "Well, Clara," the doctor said, "I think that someone's been trying to sneak up on us. What do you think?" The girl's laugh shrank to a smile as she looked at me. Then she reached her head up, wanting to whisper into the doctor's ear. He bent down to listen, then laughed again. "No, he certainly is not very good at it." Giving me a meaningful look, what said if my business wasn't important, I'd best beat it, the doctor went on, "And so, Stevie, what brings you?" I tried to keep my voice casual, not knowing just what might upset Clara. "It's Mr. Picton, sir. He says maybe it's time to call it a day." I let my tone get a little more pointed. "Seems he's had a telegram from Mr. Moore." The doctor's eyes did a little dance, but he kept his emotions under control. "I see." He glanced down at Clara, then back at me. "All right, I'll meet you at the house. 5 minutes." I nodded and departed, the doctor turning to have a serious heart-to-heart with his young patient as I went. By the time I got back to the house, the mud on my foot and leg had started to dry, but it was still sufficiently stupid-looking for El Niño to get a big damned howl out of it. He kept going as I removed my boot and tried to get myself cleaned up, but when the doctor and Clara appeared, he snapped to attention and became all respectful business. The girl found the Aborigine a strange sight, but not, it seemed, a threatening one, and she whispered a few remarks into the doctor's ear again once she'd fully sized him up. The doctor smiled and then put a hand on Clara's head, telling her that El Niño's size was normal for people like him. "He comes from the other side of the world," the doctor explained. "There are many unusual things there. You might see them some day if you like." He then crouched down to look her in the eye. "I'll be back in the morning to take you to the courthouse, Clara, and I'll stay in the room there with you, just as I promised. Only Mr. Picton will ask you any questions, so you see, there's really nothing to be afraid of. It will help. The truth will help everyone." Clara nodded, trying hard to believe the doctor's words as Josiah Weston came over to put an arm around her. Obviously very much aware that we were on the eve of Clara's first big test, Mr. Weston shook the doctor's hand with what seemed like confidence. But at the same time, I thought I could see a bit of lingering doubt in his eyes about whether they were doing the right thing. But as the doctor turned to board his hired gig, Clara rushed over and threw herself around the doctor's leg, the way I'd seen many kids at the Institute do, and I think that convinced Mr. Weston more than any words could have that they had truly started down the only path what would ever lead to any kind of real peace for her. As we rolled back along the Weston's drive, I pulled over to one side to let the doctor bring the gig up beside us and then gave him a quick version of the situation in town, or what little I knew about it. As to what Mr. Picton had meant by the doctor's business at the Westons being all taken care of, it seemed that Clara had actually started talking that morning and that the doctor had dispatched Peter Weston to town with the news immediately so that Mr. Picton would know that he could count on having the last weapon in his arsenal at the ready when he went before the grand jury. After telling me this, the doctor slowed the gig, got behind our wagon again, and then put his mind to the task of keeping up with me. The rest of our ride back was as fast and rough as the trip out had been. When we reached the courthouse,
The Morgan stallion finally made it clear through a series of heavy sighs that he'd done all the running he was going to that day. And I told El Nino, as he led the two horses and rigs back to the livery stable, to make sure that Mr. Woolley gave the remarkable animal an especially good meal and brushing down for his efforts. The sight of Mr. Picton's surrey outside the courthouse clued the doctor and me into the fact that Miss Howard had beaten us back with her charges, and the thought that the three of them might be upstairs coercing whatever mysterious news had arrived from New York out of Mr. Picton before our arrival caused us to charge into the courthouse and toward the marble steps at high speed. The big guard by the door, the one Mr. Picton had called Henry, called out to us resentfully, saying that we couldn't just go tearing around the place like we owned it, that there were rules what had to be followed, but we paid him no mind. Observing similarly few formalities when we reached Mr. Picton's offices, we just barged on in to find the others waiting. "At last," Mr. Picton said, smoking and gnawing on his pipe like one of the more nerve-racked types I'd occasionally seen during the doctor's visits to Bellevue Hospital's insane pavilion in New York. "I was afraid that if you didn't arrive soon, these three were going to physically assault me and take the telegram. But fair is fair, that's what I told them. The doctor and Stevie deserve to hear the news at the same time as everyone else." "Please," the doctor said breathlessly, ignoring Mr. Picton's kindly consideration, "go ahead." "The wire arrived at just past 6, Mr. Picton said, setting his pipe aside for the moment and adjusting himself nervously in his chair. "And it's my hope that together we can make more sense of it than I've been able to do alone. I'll just read it to you." He unfolded the thing with a loud flutter, then cleared his smoky throat and proceeded. "Mr. Rupert Picton, Ballston Spa Courthouse, Ballston Spa, urgent. L.H. declines right to appear before G. jury. Refers state to her affidavit at time of crime. Nothing more to add. Located Reverend Parker yesterday, alive though not undamaged. Will testify if guaranteed protection. Micah Hunter died yesterday of morphine overdose. Coroner says self-inflicted, but cat is now out of bag. Two local cops accompanied coroner. L.H. knows there is no official police investigation into her activities. Dusters now too dangerous for us to remain on watch. Almost killed, tailing her as she moved A.L. to their place. Trying to arrange for eyes on the inside. Vanderbilt back in town. L.H. went to him in full mourning. V. has engaged Chicago lawyer to assist in her defense. Marcus departed last night to find out who man is. I return by next available train. Would appreciate transport and large whiskey at station. Moore. "And that, my friends," Mr. Picton said, taking his pipe back up, "is the sum of things. I've checked the timetables. John should be arriving at about 11, though of course there'll be delays, which gives us several hours in which to figure out just what he's talking about." Mr. Picton waved the telegram above his head. "Some of it's obvious, of course, and none too surprising. I didn't honestly expect Libby to show up for the grand jury proceedings, for instance, but there are other elements that are quite confusing." The doctor got up and reached toward the telegram. "May I?" "Oh, yes, of course, doctor," Mr. Picton answered, handing the thing over. "You've known John far longer than I have, after all, so perhaps you'll do better with some of his vague references, starting with the statement that Reverend Parker is alive but not undamaged." "Either Moore was simply demonstrating his usual clarity of language," the doctor answered in what you might call a dry tone of voice, scanning the piece of paper, "or he didn't want to take the chance that anyone might get hold of a copy of the message. Vanderbilt's reappearance, looked at in such a light, is somewhat sinister." "Yes," Lucius agreed. "There's not a lot his people wouldn't be able to find out if they had a mind to." "I'd be willing to bet," Miss Howard said, "that the business about Parker means that Libby did sic the dusters on him at some point. If John and Marcus could find him, she must have been able to also, and God knows what shape he ended up in." Cyrus shook his head. "Bad enough to make his life a genuine misery, I expect, miss," he said quietly. "Maybe bad enough to make him wish he was dead. It might be that she'd take more satisfaction from that than from actually having him killed." Miss Howard gave Cyrus a grim look, what indicated she agreed with him. The doctor, too, nodded. "Yes," he said, still studying the telegram, "but a more permanent solution was apparently necessary for Micah Hunter. That, too, is understandable. He probably never knew anything about what happened up here before he married Libby. But when Marcus brought the news about the grand jury, Hunter doubtless began to suspect the truth. and it wouldn't have been much work, even for his drug-ridden brain, to draw the obvious inferences about the ill-fated children his wife had been attending to in New York. Mr. Picton cocked his head, with something that almost looked like respect in his face. "Killing him's a clever tactic for the trial, too. Libby'll now arrive in the clothing of a recent widow, who spent years nursing a Civil War veteran." His look of strange admiration suddenly turned into a wince. "My God, what a depressing thought. Judges, juries, and the public are prone enough to side with a woman during a trial, but the grieving widow of a Union soldier? Nothing like a black dress and the flag to bring out sympathy. But tell me, Doctor, what does Moore mean when he says he's trying to arrange for eyes on the inside?"
"It relates to yet another clever move on our antagonist's part, I'm afraid," the doctor replied. "I had hoped that if summoned to Ballston Spa, she would arrange for some temporary caretaker to look after Anna in her house."
"And why would that have helped our cause?" Mr. Picton asked.
"It wouldn't," the doctor answered, "not in terms of the trial at any rate, but in the event that we fail, and she's acquitted."
"Then she'd have to get rid of that caretaker and returning to New York," Lucius finished for him with a nod, grabbing hold of the idea. "And with any luck, we could have been there to catch her in the act and prevent it."
"Or, if we failed in that attempt, we would at least have had, and I do not mean to sound excessively callous here, another murder which we might have attempted to lay at her door," the doctor said. "Now, however, knowing that the police are not, in fact, investigating her, she can be far bolder. Moore says that they actually saw her transferring the child to the Duster's headquarters, a place the police do not frequent without the strongest of motivations." Pausing, the doctor focused his eyes more sharply on the telegram. "I'd say that John is endeavoring to find someone within, or at least close to, the Dusters who will be willing to keep watch over Anna. For if we should succeed in convicting Libby, the child's fate will be sealed unless we have inside help."
"But who could he possibly contact?" Lucius said. "I mean, even approaching anybody who's known to frequent that place would get him a broken skull." At that point I became aware of a pair of eyes fixing on mine, and looked over to see Cyrus staring at me.
"Not necessarily," he said gently, and as he did, my own heart sank with the realization of what or who he was talking about.
"What do you mean, Cyrus?" Miss Howard asked. "Who could he possibly—"
Following Cyrus's gaze and looking at me, Miss Howard suddenly caught on. The doctor and Lucius also glanced my way, knowingly and uncomfortably. All of this attention caused me to start shifting my feet.
"But," I said quietly, "but she's gone." My heart beating faster by the second, I soon found it impossible to keep my voice down. "She's gone. She went to California."
"We don't know that, Stevie," the doctor said evenly, "and there doesn't seem to be anyone else that Moore could possibly be referring to."
I'd started to shake my head even before he'd finished talking. "No," I said, in an effort to convince myself as much as anyone else. "She left. She's gone."
But then I remembered the glimpse of Ding Dong I'd caught on the 22nd Street pier before our departure from the city, and my voice died away as I realized that my argument wasn't worth the air it took to voice it.
"I'm afraid I'm a bit behind here," Mr. Picton said, puffing on his pipe and seeming to sense that the moment was a tricky one. "It may, of course, be none of my business, but who are you all talking about?"
The doctor, once he saw that, though I was still upset, I was starting to get myself under some kind of control, turned to Mr. Picton. "It is the friend of Stevie's of whom you've heard us speak, Miss Devlin. We had thought that she'd left the city for California." He glanced my way once more. "It would appear that we were mistaken."
"But that's splendid!" Mr. Picton's warm, loud words threw me and everybody else in the room off kilter for a second. I looked up to give him a very puzzled stare. "Well, I mean," he went on, with warm-hearted sincerity, "the girl's been a great help with the case so far, Stevie. If she's still in New York, what better person to continue to ask for assistance?"
The thought, one what none of us who actually knew Cat would have come up with, was strangely comforting, and I found that it had the effect of calming the pounding in my head and my chest to the extent that I could even nod a bit.
"That's true, Stevie," Miss Howard said in her most encouraging tone. "We don't have any reason to believe that Cat won't do what's right. She has so far, after all, whatever her flashes of temper." Even Cyrus, who knew best of all of them how open to question Cat's participation would probably be, tried to be positive about the notion.
"They've got a point, Stevie. She's a tough girl, and Lord knows she's unpredictable. But she's done right by us at every turn."
"Yeah," I said softly. "I guess that's so." But I wasn't going to buy into the thing fully until I saw a look of certainty in the doctor's face. I turned, but the look wasn't there.
"We have to hope, Stevie," he said, one of his eyebrows arched.
He'd never lied to me in the past, and I think he knew I wouldn't have wanted him to start at that point.
"It's all we can do. But it won't be blind hope. That much at least is the truth. She has truly been a help to us in this business."
I just nodded again, swallowing hard and ready to move on to some other subject, being as I wouldn't be able to begin to come to real terms with the question of Cat till later, when I could have a few smokes on my own. Thankfully, the doctor moved everyone's attention onto other matters by going back to the telegram.
"The final question, Vin, and I fear the most perplexing, is who the devil this Chicago lawyer Moore mentions may be."
"Perplexing indeed," Mr. Picton said, standing up and heading over to his window. He glanced out it and started to tug at the bristly ginger hair on his head so hard I thought the stuff might start coming out in clumps.
"Chicago? Why in God's name Chicago? New York has the best criminal trial attorneys in the country, and with Vanderbilt behind her, Libby could have any one of them."
"Maybe Vanderbilt's got some special contact in Chicago," Lucius said. "He must have some reason for going that far afield for help. After all, he's no fool." "No," Mr. Picton agreed, kicking at a pile of papers on the floor. "But he is a railroad man. The only people he'd have any reason to be well acquainted with in Chicago would be corporation lawyers. I can't see where one of them would—" At that moment we all turned at the sound of a knock on the outer office door. It was quickly followed by the voice of the guard from downstairs.
"Mr. Picton! Mr. Picton, sir!"
"It's all right, Henry," Mr. Picton shouted. "Come in." The big guard opened the outer door slowly, then cautiously made his way inside, slouching over slightly in what looked to me like some kind of automatic deference at being in one of the offices. He was holding an envelope.
"This just came for you, sir," he said, handing the item over as Mr. Picton crossed the room to receive it.
"From the Western Union office. I told him to bill the DA's account."
"Well, that was quick thinking, Henry," Mr. Picton said as he started to open the envelope.
The guard frowned, not knowing whether Mr. Picton was serious or mocking him. But the shorter man's next comment made his attitude pretty clear.
"Do you know everyone, Henry?" he said, looking up into the guard's pasty, small-eyed face and then indicating the rest of us. "Or shall I make introductions?"
The man scowled down at Mr. Picton.
"No, sir," he said glumly. Then he turned the dumb, injured look on the rest of us. "I guess I know him all right, sir."
"Well, then," Mr. Picton said, "if you're waiting for a tip, I can only remind you that it's against county policy. Good evening, Henry." Not knowing how to respond to that, the guard simply nodded and then lumbered moodily back out the door.
"Idiot," Mr. Picton mumbled once he'd gone. "To think that someone with a mind might actually make use of all the food and oxygen it takes to keep that sort of—"
He stopped as he got the envelope open.
"Well, news from Marcus."
Scanning the thing quickly, Mr. Picton shrugged and then handed it to the doctor, crossing back to his desk.
"Though precious little, he seems to have learned the name of the lawyer Vanderbilt's engaged. He's trying to assemble a case record on the man and talk to some people who have dealt with him. There's a possibility that he can get an interview with the fellow himself, too."
"All that could be helpful," Lucius commented with a shrug.
"What's his name, Rupert?" Miss Howard asked. "Do you recognize it?"
Mr. Picton was gazing out his window, pulling at his hair again.
"Hmm? Oh, Darrow, Clarence Darrow. I can't quite place it, but there is something—"
"I've no knowledge of him, certainly," the doctor said simply, dropping the telegram onto the desk.
Mr. Picton kept struggling, then threw up his hands.
"Nor, it appears, do I,"
he said, his face twisting unhappily. Then it straightened out.
"Or do I? There was something—"
"Wait a minute." Bolting across the room, he gathered a stack of law journals, what were piled on the floor, up into his arms, then threw them onto his desk.
"Somewhere there's something."
going through the journals in his usual style, which meant hurling them around the room so that the rest of us had to occasionally duck to keep from taking one of them in the mouth, Mr. Picton eventually grabbed the particular number he'd been looking for.
"Aha!" he said, collapsing into his chair. "Yes, here it is. A piece that mentions Clarence Darrow, who is, in fact, on the payroll of the Chicago and Northwestern Railway, though it's only a part-time retainer. But he used to be their corporation counsel, and that's no doubt where Vanderbilt first heard of him."
"But I still don't understand," the doctor said. "Why hire a corporate attorney for a criminal case?"
"Well," Mr. Picton answered, holding up a finger, "there are some interesting details that may provide an answer. You remember the Pullman strike back in 94?
There were general mumblings in the affirmative, as we all thought back to the infamous time when the American Railway Union had struck against the Pullman Car Company in Chicago. The battles that had taken place during the action had been so infamous and so bloody that even I'd heard them mentioned among those labor-minded enthusiasts what made up the most loud-mouthed portion of the population in my old neighborhood. Well, despite the fact that he was still a consulting attorney for the Chicago and Northwestern, Clarence Darrow agreed to represent Eugene Debs and several other officers of the Railway Workers' Union. It wasn't a criminal trial. Debs and the others were only charged with inciting the workers to strike, which is technically an antitrust matter, but Darrow managed to argue the thing all the way to the Supreme Court, just the same.
Mr. Picton flipped a few more pages of the journal, growing silent.
"And?" Miss Howard asked.
"And he lost, of course," Mr. Picton answered. "But it was quite a good fight. And more importantly, while Debs and the others were serving several months in jail for the civil violations, they were indicted on a more serious criminal charge, attempting to obstruct the mails by way of the railway strike. Darrow took the case again and won by default. The government eventually dropped the charges. So while he lost the less serious civil case, Darrow won the more important criminal one."
"Which doesn't tell us," Lucius said, "why Mr. Vanderbilt thinks that a man who splits his time between working for railroad corporations and workers' unions, a combination that strikes me as awfully odd, by the way, is the ideal candidate to come in on a murder case."
"No," Mr. Picton answered, his mood brightening.
"No, it doesn't. But I'll tell you, Detective, I'm relieved. Whatever Darrow's talents may be, Vanderbilt could, as I say, have brought some very big guns up from New York once he chose to get involved."
"Perhaps that's the point," the doctor said. "Perhaps Mr. Vanderbilt senses that there may be something untoward about this case and doesn't want his name connected to it in any New York circles."
Mr. Picton considered that, then nodded.
"I suspect you're right, doctor. I suspect you're absolutely right. Doubtless Marcus can confirm the theory for us when he gets back, but for now—" Mr. Picton clamped his pipe between his teeth and put his hands on his hips— "I vote that we go home and have ourselves a pleasant dinner. Things are starting to look up, I dare say."
Feeling much relieved by this turn of events, as well as by Mr. Picton's confidence, we all started to head for the office door, hungry and more than ready to take his advice regarding a relaxing evening at home. True, we had the grand jury to wrangle with in the morning, but with Clara Hatch now talking, there seemed little reason to think that we wouldn't proceed easily past that obstacle to the criminal trial what lay beyond, where, we happily assured ourselves, we'd be faced by a lawyer inexperienced in such cases who wouldn't be able to put up much of a fight against two men as seasoned in these sorts of contests as the doctor and Mr. Picton. It was one of the worst errors of judgment we made during the entire case.
Chapter 40. Mr. Moore arrived that night, looking bedraggled and persecuted, and rightfully so. He'd had a pretty devilish week in the city, and had barely gotten back out with all of his organs and limbs intact. And even when he and Marcus hadn't been in situations where their lives were in immediate danger, like when they'd gone to interview the Reverend Clayton Parker, violence had been a topic of conversation. Apparently the Reverend had been set on about 6 months earlier by several men who we could reasonably assume to have been Hudson Dusters, and had had both of his kneecaps shattered with baseball bats, along with one of his ears cut off. Even as he retold the story to us, Mr. Moore got so jittery that he needed a couple of stiff belts of Mr. Picton's best whiskey to calm his nerves. But the news that we were ready to face the grand jury the next morning cheered him up considerably, as did the leftovers from our dinner,
with which he stuffed himself till fairly late in Mr. Picton's kitchen. By the time he retired, he'd taken in enough encouraging intelligence, along with enough whiskey, to be able to sleep as soundly as the rest of us. Before I could let him go to the rest he so richly deserved, though, I had to find out whether he'd actually been in touch with Cat, and, if he had, what the outcome had been. As he was unsteadily scrubbing his teeth in his bathroom, after pouring half a tin of Sozodont powder over his brush and into the sink, I snuck on in and put the questions. His mouth foaming like a mad dog's, Mr. Moore told me that yes, he'd met up with Cat outside Duster territory and informed her about our predicament, then asked if she'd be willing to keep a watchful eye on Anna Linares. Cat had demanded money for her services, making it seem certain to me that all we'd given her, and probably the train ticket, too, had gone to Ding Dong. But Mr. Moore said that such wasn't the case, that Cat had shown him the ticket and told him that she was just waiting for word from her aunt before setting out for California. When I asked Mr. Moore if he thought Cat was still blowing the Bernie, he answered that he hadn't been able to tell, in a nervous way, what made it plain he was lying. But I decided that all I had time or energy to do was take heart from the fact that Cat still had the train ticket and was still willing to work for us. The rest I'd have to cope with when we got back to New York. Mr. Picton had prepared us for the possibility that some of the townsfolk of Ballston Spa would take an interest in the activities of the deliberative body what was slated to convene on Friday morning at 11 in the smaller wing chamber of the county courthouse. But we weren't at all ready, and I don't think he was either, for the sight that greeted us when we rolled up to the building in the Surrey. There must have been 100 people, of every age, size, and description, on the steps and lawn of the place, milling around like so many hungry chickens. The guard Henry was at the top of the steps, barring the entrance, being as the activities of grand juries are not open to the public, a fact what many of those would-be spectators were obviously unaware of. But the big, horse-faced Henry seemed to be talking sympathetically with the crowd as much as holding them at bay. And the closer we got, the clearer it became that the general mood among all of them, Henry included, was not a happy one. "Oh, good," Mr. Picton said as he reined his horse to a halt. Then he huffed in an irritated manner, causing his pipe to shoot sparks upward. "I was so hoping that my fellow citizens would take an interest in the proceedings. Nothing like the public getting involved in the affairs of government, especially when they're too ignorant to know at what point they're not allowed to be involved." He brought the Surrey to a halt, and picking up one of the several big stacks of books and files what were sitting on the floor under the driver's bench, jumped down to the street. "I'd advise you not to fetch Clara alone, Dr. Kreitzler," he said, as the doctor moved up from the back to the front seat. "God knows how many more of these people have come out to offer their opinions in other parts of town." "Cyrus and Stevie will accompany me," the doctor answered with a nod as I moved on up to take the reins.
"And El Niño, too,"
the aborigine said, swinging around toward us from his perch on the outside of the rig.
"If you have El Niño to guard you, there will be no trouble for the señor doctor."
He flashed a grin, one that the doctor, even in that uncertain situation, couldn't help but return. "Very well, El Niño," he said. "You shall come along, too, but don't be too quick to reach for the tools of your trade." The doctor glanced at the crowd in front of the courthouse. "People such as these are to be feared more for their ignorance than for their daring."
"Yes, señor doctor,"
El Niño said, jumping onto the back seat beside Cyrus as Mr. Moore vacated the spot.
"It's true."
"You don't want me to come along, too, Laszlo?"
Mr. Moore said, still looking sleepy after his first decent night's rest in 5 days.
"I think we're an impressive enough little escort, John," the doctor said, eyeing those of us what were still in the Surrey.
"And someone's got to get Mr. Picton through that crowd. Someone, that is," the doctor gave Miss Howard a quick smile, "who won't reach immediately for a firearm."
"Oh, my hands will be full," Miss Howard answered, smiling as she picked up another pile of books and files. "Fortunately for these people."
"It's all very well to joke," Lucius said, wiping his forehead, which was shining bright in the hot morning sun.
"But you will be careful, doctor. The girl is the key to our case, after all."
"Yes, Detective Sergeant," the doctor answered, "and a good deal more than that. No harm will come to her or to anyone else, I pledge you that."
"And so does El Niño,"
declared the aborigine, at which I smiled to the detective sergeant.
"And so does El Niño," I said, clicking my tongue at Mr. Picton's horse and starting us slowly on our way. As we drove, we turned to keep an eye on the other four as they made their way through the crowd in front of the courthouse, Mr. Picton's pipe still blazing like the smokestack of a forge as he greeted faces he recognized with a cheeriness what couldn't have been more phony.
"Ah, Mr. Groves, I am relieved to see a representative of our weekly journal and the editor himself. This is truly gratifying. A man in my line of work rarely experiences such an exhibition of support."
We began to drift out of earshot, just as an irritated voice replied to Mr. Picton,
"The Boston Weekly Journal most definitely does not intend to support you, sir, if you are truly seeking an indictment against the unfortunate Mrs. Hatch."
The last piece of this conversation we heard was Mr. Picton's reply.
"Ah, what a pity. Sheriff Dunning, you will remind these people, including friend Groves here, that these proceedings are closed to the public, won't you? Good man."
A heavy sigh came out of the doctor, and I turned to him.
"Bloody hell,"
he whispered, turning away from the scene in front of the courthouse and then rubbing his bad arm with his right hand.
"It begins already."
When we reached the Westons' farm, we found the whole family out in front of the house and gathered around their carriage, a simple but dignified rig what bore a shiny new coat of black paint. They looked like they were ready for church, scrubbed and dressed in the kind of somber, formal clothing what they most likely only brought out for Sundays, weddings, and funerals. The doctor boarded the carriage with them, sitting next to Clara on one seat, while Mr. and Mrs. Weston took the other, and Kate climbed onto the driver's bench with Peter, who had the reins. Clara was a picture of nervousness and confusion, of course, her golden eyes as round and skittish as a spooked thoroughbred's. Almost as soon as the doctor was in the carriage, he got her to open her sketch pad and start working with her pencils. The best way, he obviously figured, to keep her mind off where she was going and why. As Peter started down the drive, I pulled the surrey in behind him, and all the way back to town, Cyrus, El Niño, and I kept a careful lookout for any curious or hostile faces what might appear by the road. We didn't catch sight of any till we were back on the edge of Boston Spa, but the cold stares we started to receive at that point indicated that word about what was going on at the courthouse had spread all through the village. The general reaction seemed to be the same as the one exhibited by those brave souls who'd marched up to the courthouse steps in a pack. It wasn't exactly a mob mentality. I'd seen mobs at work, and this was something different. The citizens of Boston Spa seemed mostly bewildered. Their faces were disturbed and furrowed, and plainly displayed the wish that we would disappear back to the evil city what had disgorged us.
"It is strange, Señorito Stevie,"
El Niño remarked at one point.
"These people, they do not wish for Bibiana to be found?"
"They don't really get the connection," I answered as we rolled by the Eagle Hotel and netted a whole slew of new glares. "And we can't tell them, because the señor says so. It's a secret, if you get my meaning."
"So,"
El Niño answered with a nod,
"that is why they look this way. If they know the story of Bibiana, they feel different, sure."
I hoped like hell that the aborigine was right. Back up at the courthouse, the scene hadn't changed much. And as our two rigs moved along High Street, one heavy-set man with a thick gray mustache, wearing a wide-brimmed straw hat and a badge on the lapel of his jacket, approached us.
"Josiah," he said, in a polite but serious tone of voice, signaling to Mr. Weston.
"Sheriff Dunning," Mr. Weston answered with a nod, his voice betraying no emotion. "Few folks here."
"Yes, sir," Sheriff Dunning answered, looking a little uneasily at the crowd. "Nothing serious, but you'll want to take your rig around back, maybe. Come in through the ground floor. Be easier on everybody."
He glanced once at Clara.
"Hello there, little miss," he said with a smile. "Come to visit the courthouse, have you?"
As an answer, Clara hid herself behind the doctor's arm, at which point the sheriff turned his gaze up to meet the doctor's. The man's smile vanished in the process.
"Anyway, Josiah," Sheriff Dunning said, "I just figure that'll be the easier way to go about it."
Mr. Weston nodded, then turned his rig onto Bath Street and rolled down the hill toward the back entrance to the courthouse. I made a move to follow with the surrey, but Cyrus reached up to grab my arm.
"No, Stevie," he said,
The front door. Let's make sure those folks don't follow them down.
I knew what he meant. Between Cyrus and El Nino, the focus of the crowd's attention was likely to stay on our carriage wherever it went. And if we just pulled up in front of the courthouse and brassed it out by heading in at the main entrance, we were likely to make certain that Clara and the Westons would get inside without any trouble. So I slapped Mr. Picton's horse into a nice high step and made as much of a deal as I could out of the half block that we had left to cover. True to Cyrus's reasoning, every eye in the crowd turned on us as we got down off the Surrey and made our way toward the steps. There were a few laughs, but more clicks of the tongue and mild curses, and of course the occasional mumbling of damned niggers and the like were heard, all of them designed to get some kind of a reaction out of Cyrus and El Nino. But those bright souls what gave voice to the slurs didn't know who they were dealing with. For El Nino, if he heard them, didn't register any awareness of what they meant, while Cyrus had long since learned to hold his emotions down when such labels were flung at him. At the front door we came face to face with the guard Henry, who, seeming to care quite a bit about what the crowd would think of his next move, took to biting at the nails of one hand.
"What's this, Henry?"
said one pompous-looking man in a suit, whose voice I recognized as belonging to the editor of the Ballston Weekly Journal, Mr. Groves.
"Are respected citizens of this community and members of the press to be denied entry to these proceedings, while children and, well—"
Mr. Gross's eyes went from Cyrus to El Nino.
"Savages are to be allowed in?"
Plainly not knowing what to do, Henry obeyed the instincts of the true follower. He crossed his arms, widened his stance, and then looked Cyrus in the eye.
"Sorry," he said. "The grand jury's
deliberations,"
Cyrus supplied with a straight face. The guard's eyes filled with resentment.
"The deliberations are closed to the public."
"Sir," Cyrus answered quietly, "you know that we're investigators in the employ of Assistant District Attorney Picton, and we know you know it. So you can either let us through now, or you can play up to this crowd and explain your decision to Mr. Picton later. He's your superior."
Cyrus nodded toward the general area behind him.
"These people aren't."
Somebody behind me mumbled, "Smart-ass nigger!" And then I saw a hand appear from out of the closing swarm of bodies to grab Cyrus's shoulder. The arm connected to the hand tried to pull my friend backward, and the face on the owner of the arm was filled with a resentment obviously fortified by a few morning drinks. But whoever the fellow was, he'd let liquor lead him to a bad decision. Cyrus just grabbed the fingers what were fixed on his shoulder in his own hand and then held them up an inch or so. Keeping his eyes fixed on the guard Henry's face, Cyrus began to squeeze, and as beads of sweat appeared on Henry's face, Cyrus started to squeeze very hard. Now, Cyrus has always had a grip that's got a lot in common with your average steel vise, and after about 20 seconds or so you could hear the man who'd grabbed him starting to whimper. Then came the sound of bones crunching, at which the man started to plain howl.
All right," Henry said, stepping away from the door. "Get inside, the three of you, but I'm telling Mr. Picton about this."
Cyrus assured Henry that he'd also be letting Mr. Picton know exactly what had happened. Then we slipped through the door, slamming it closed as the crowd outside started to make louder and angrier noises. Inside the main hall, we saw Mr. Moore, Miss Howard, and Lucius anxiously pacing outside the doorway to the small hearing room, which was over on the left-hand side of the space.
"What the hell was all that about?" Mr. Moore said, as we moved quickly over to them.
"Seems like tempers are getting pretty hot already," I answered. "One of those mugs tried to start something with Cyrus."
"Are you all right?"
Miss Howard said, looking up at Cyrus's barely rattled features.
"He is all right, sure," El Nino answered, staring up at Cyrus in awe. "He is El Maestro. Not all of those pigs outside can challenge Mr. Montrose."
A little embarrassed, Cyrus just nodded to Miss Howard.
"Nothing out of the ordinary, miss. Have they begun the proceedings?"
"I think so," she answered. "They let the family go in with Clara, thank God. She was as pale as a sheet by the time she actually got up here."
"Well," I said, trying to sneak a peek through the crack between the sliding mahogany doors of the hearing room, but unable to see anything. "Looks like it's a waiting game for a while." I held up my hands, and yes, before anybody asks, I've got plenty of cigarettes.
It was an anxious time, those next couple of hours. With nowhere to go, a walk outside being pretty effectively ruled out, and nothing to do but smoke and worry. Whoever had built the doors in that courthouse had turned in some solid work, for along with being unable to spot anything through the cracks, we never heard any sound clearer than vague mumbling coming from inside, and precious little of that. Mr. Moore remarked that such was a good sign, but good or not, it was strange and not a little disturbing to be standing outside a courtroom without ever hearing the usual sounds of argument. We didn't even get the occasional echo of a banging gavel, for a grand jury proceeding, like I've said, was and is the district attorney's show, or in this case, the assistant DA's, and there was no judge inside that chamber to go messing with the way things were conducted. There was just Mr. Picton, his evidence and witnesses, and the jury itself. Given such an arrangement and the limited amount of noise what bled out through the door, there did seem to be good reason for us to believe that things were going pretty well. And as the time dragged on, each one of us tried harder and harder to accept that idea. For once, our assumptions turned out to match the facts. At about 1:30, we heard the sounds of chairs and feet moving around inside the hearing room, and then the mahogany doors slid open, an officer of the court manning each slab. The doctor and the Westons were the first ones out of the room, the doctor speaking with some feeling to the still pale Clara, but as he passed by the rest of us, he managed a small, sure nod, saying in no uncertain terms that they'd gotten the indictment. There was a quick moment of mutual congratulation among the rest of us, but it was cut short by the sight of the Weston family coming out of the hearing room. Old Josiah looked like he'd been through a battle, and his wife, Ruth, was very pale and wan. In fact, she would have collapsed to the floor, I think, if Peter and Kate hadn't been holding her up by the arms. As they passed by, any joy we felt was doused by the cold realization both of what had just happened and what remained to be done, and of how much danger they all might be in once Libby Hatch was brought back to Ballston Spa. The members of the grand jury stayed milling around inside the hearing room as if they were afraid to come out. And when Mr. Picton eventually emerged with Sheriff Dunning, the lawman looked so rattled and confused that it was easy to tell that the town of Ballston Spa, which had spent the morning being so confused and hostile, was about to get a shake-up what would magnify those feelings many times over. Mr. Picton had his pipe out, and he was sticking it in the sheriff's face like a pistol as he lectured him. "And I mean it, Dunning. Whatever your personal opinions about this matter, due process has been served, and I expect you and every other officer of the court and the law in this county to respect and uphold the grand jury's findings. That includes extending your protection to whatever persons my office may choose to work with, as well as anyone else I think may need it. District Attorney Pearson will be absent for the duration of this affair, so I'll be in charge. I hope I'm not the only one who realizes that, and I hope I make myself clear." The sheriff held up a hand. "Mr. Picton, sir, you can spare the effort. I'll admit I wasn't in favor of this investigation, nor of this hearing, before today, but after what I seen and heard in there—" The man's sun-creased eyes wandered to Clara Hatch, and it seemed to me like maybe a tear or two might come out of them. "Well, sir," he went on, stroking his big gray mustache, "I'm man enough to admit when I've been wrong. And I've been wrong about this one." He turned the tough eyes to Mr. Picton again. "We'll get the woman up here, sir, provided the New York cops give us a hand. And all I can say concerning what comes after that is—" Sheriff Dunning held out a hand. "I hope the Lord stays with you, Mr. Picton, because you're doing his work." Mr. Picton, who might have been expected to at least show some gratitude or emotion in response to this pretty earnest eating of crow, just shook the sheriff's hand quickly and nodded, making it clear that praise and damnation from such people were all one and the same to him. "Well, the Lord's work right now involves me talking to that crowd outside," he said, with a flick of his head. "So if you and your deputies will just clear me a spot on the steps—"
"Yes, sir,"
the sheriff answered quickly. "Right away. Abe, Gully, let's go, boys." The three men moved toward the front door, what was still tightly closed, while the rest of us fell in behind them. A strange kind of thrill, exciting but frightening and maybe a little sad at the same time, was beginning to course through me, and I think that all the other members of our team felt the same way.
As for the Weston family, the only parts of said emotion they shared were the fear and the sadness. That much was pretty obvious. They clustered around Clara like a human wall, as if they thought someone might try to snatch her right out of their midst. Given the mood outside the courthouse, such didn't seem an unreasonable attitude either. As the door cracked open, the same angry, mumbling what we'd left outside 2.5 hours ago started up again. And Sheriff Dunning and his boys had to do a little coaxing and finally some straight-out pushing and shoving to clear a little place at the top of the steps for Mr. Picton. Stepping out and putting a match to his pipe, Mr. Picton looked out over the bobbing, grousing heads with an expression of what you might call extreme disdain. After he'd let them shout at him for 2 or 3 minutes, he held his hands up. All right, get yourselves under some kind of control now, if that's possible," he shouted. "Neither the sheriff nor I have any desire to declare this an illegal assembly, but I've got to ask that you listen to what I have to say very carefully." The general level of noise died down, and then Mr. Picton scanned the faces in front of him more closely. "Is Mr. Groves still here?"
"I am,"
came the voice of the newspaper editor in return. He moved up to the front of the crowd. "Though I'm not too happy about standing in the midday July sun for hours on end, sir, I will say." "Quite understandable," Mr. Picton answered. "But the wages of rabble-rousing have never been just, have they, Mr. Groves? At any rate, I'd like you to get the following details straight, so I don't have to repeat them endlessly during the coming weeks. The grand jury has met, and it has made its decision, and we all owe that decision our respect." "Indeed we do," Mr. Groves said, looking around with a smile. "I hope you're prepared to respect it, Mr. Picton." "Oh, I am, Mr. Groves," Mr. Picton answered, delighted to discover that the editor was assuming that the state had lost its bid. "I am. At this moment, an indictment is being prepared against Mrs. Elspeth Hunter of New York City, formerly Mrs. Elspeth Hatch of Ballston Spa, formerly Miss Elspeth Fraser of Stillwater, New York. She is charged with the first-degree murder of Thomas Hatch and Matthew Hatch, as well as the attempted murder of Clara Hatch, all on the night of the 31st of May, 1894. I'll admit that I'd thought the crowd might break out into a good old-fashioned riot at this news, so I was surprised, as was Mr. Picton from the look of him, when the sounds what came out of those citizens were ones of hushed horror, as if some ghost had just wandered across their collective path.
What are you saying?" Mr. Groves asked.
Then he looked to Sheriff Dunning. "Phil, does he mean—" The sheriff just gave Mr. Groves a long and serious stare.
"I'd let him finish if I were you, Horace."
As the crowd quieted, Mr. Picton, no longer quite so testy as he'd been, finished his statement. "We have physical evidence that will demonstrate the woman's guilt. We have a powerful motive that will be supported by witnesses, and we have an eyewitness to the shooting. This office would not take action on a matter like this with anything less." Mr. Picton paused, still looking like he expected some kind of an outburst from the crowd, but all he got was a sudden cry of, "Jesus H. Christ!" from one man at the back of the herd, who immediately turned and started running down toward the trolley station. As he went, I caught enough of a glimpse of his face to be able to identify him. It was the waiter who'd taken care of us at Canfield's Casino. It didn't take a genius to figure out that he'd been sent by his boss to find out the latest developments in the case so that odds on the trial could be posted at the casino for those of Mr. Canfield's clients who didn't get enough satisfaction out of roulette, poker, and faro. But the man obviously hadn't been ready for what he'd heard, and judging by how fast he beat it to the trolley station, I guessed that Saratoga's true gamesmen were going to be able to get some very long odds on a conviction from Mr. Canfield starting that night. As for the rest of the crowd, they just continued to stand and stare blankly at Mr. Picton, in the same sort of way that people all over town had stared at us when we'd brought Clara to the courthouse that morning. They were still resentful, all right, but added to the resentment now was the kind of confusion that an angry cow feels when it's been smacked in the forehead with a shovel. It didn't seem like most of them even knew what to do with themselves until Sheriff Dunning stepped out in front of Mr. Picton.
"That all, sir?"
the sheriff asked.
"Yes, Dunning," Mr. Picton answered. "You'd better break them up. There's nothing more to say."
"Nothing more to say?"
It was Mr. Groves, his voice now very different than it had been before. The pompous arrogance was all gone.
"Picton," he went on quietly, "do you realize what you've already said?"
Mr. Picton nodded very seriously.
"Yes, I do, Horace, and I'd be grateful if you'd print it in full in tomorrow's edition."
His silver eyes moved out over the crowd as he smoked.
"This isn't a matter for sidewalk debate, ladies and gentlemen. The town of Ballston Spa and the county of Saratoga will be forced to search their souls in the days to come. Let's hope we can live with what we find."
With that, Mr. Picton turned and came back inside, while Sheriff Dunning and his men gently started to break the crowd up. Closing the courthouse door slowly, Mr. Picton then approached the doctor.
"Well," he said, "as you suspected, Doctor, we'll have no disturbances, yet."
The doctor nodded. "The sinister phenomena implied by this crime resonate far deeper in the human soul than anyone can immediately grasp. You've been struggling with them for years now, Mr. Picton,